Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before, just a stone's throw from your front door.
Well, hello, hello. We start today's recording in a spiral stairwell. And I'm looking up above me. I'm being led by Ian Tuckett up a spiral stairwell. We're at the top of the Oxo Tower, and we met on the 8th floor at the public viewing gallery and the restaurant and brasserie there. And Ian was good enough to suggest that a quieter place might be a little further up, and he's produced a key. And I can't resist a man with a key. We've reached a gantry level, and now we're moving up a second spiral stair. It's a bit wobbly. How old is this staircase, Ian?
Oh, this is the original one. So it was 1928 to 1930 that the tower was added to the building. Originally, it was built around 1900. And it was an electricity generating station for the post office. But in 1928 to 30, it was extended. You can see a kink along the river frontage, and the tower was added, and it became a warehouse where they unloaded the meat from the barges, stored it in the cold store, and then processed it and packed it. And it wasn't just Oxo, which is obviously what people now know because of the tower. It was all those sort of meats that I don't personally eat. And it was one of the brilliant ideas of the architect, Albert Moore, to get round the ban on sky advertising by designing the windows of the tower in a way that just spelled out Oxo.
That's terrifically clever. We stopped for breath there at... we're in fact behind one of the sets of O windows. Are we at the top O or the bottom O?
Bad news for you, mate, is that we're at the bottom O. You've got an X and an O before you get to the top.
We better keep moving. I'll introduce you properly, listener, in just a moment. Through the crisscross windows, I can see the Thames on three sides. I suppose my anxiety here is that these stairwells might not have been designed for somebody of my size. I'm sure we'll be okay. We're passing the X now.
So you've got one more to do.
Yes, at the welcome site of another O.
And then turn you the other way just to stop you getting dizzy.
Is that really the reason?
I have no idea.
I'm willing to believe it.
There you go.
We've made it.
So it's a bit misty today, but when it clears, you can see Ali Pali up there to the north and Crystal Palace down to the south. And of course, we're on this huge bend of the River Thames just here. Londoners traditionally think of the Thames as being, or did think of the Thames as just being a straight line. And, you know, London proper used to be on the north bank. And then they put, you know, whether it was jails, the Clink in Clink Street, or, you know, the theatres like the Globe and all of that, or indeed a lot of the prostitution was all sort of had to be outside the proper city and so got slung onto the South Bank, and that's where a lot of the entertainment started. So obviously the sort of famous Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens, even the King used to come over and you know, have a good time, and Queen Victoria, despite her black attire.
Well, she wasn't. What are you saying about Queen Victoria?
Well, she, in all the pictures I ever seen of her, she's always dressed in black. And indeed, what people usually refer to as the dolphin lights that line the riverside walkway used to be red, blue and white. You know, they were sort of Union Jackie colours. But I understand they all got painted black at some stage. Now, whether that was, I think it was in you know, at one point when maybe, the trouble is I don't know my dates on that one, but it was, they have remained black ever since. And actually, they're sturgeons round the bottom of the bend round the lamps, and not dolphins. And but they are a good memory of the time when the river, before the Industrial Revolution, used to be where people not only got their water to drink, but also their fish to eat. And salmon were actually the that's what the poor people used to eat.
I've heard the same thing about oysters.
Oh, you know, you wouldn't catch me eating oysters, but I mean, you know, until a few years ago, we used to, you know, have one of the famous jellied eel and what have you shops here. But you know, we've lost in this area our wet fish shop and our some of the basic shops. And funnily enough, that's how one of the reasons Coin Street Community Builders came into being, was because the shops were all closing, the schools were closing, the population had fallen from 50,000 to 4,500, and it had been written off as an area by the planners for where the people should live. It was in future going to be an extension of the city and the West End. And of course, planners, unlike, you know, the picture that Londoners generally had of the river as being a flat line, planners could see that there's a huge bend in the river at this point that makes us geographically right between the city and the West End. So you can see the city over there, St. Paul's, and then
over this way. There's the Houses of Parliament, London Eye.
You're off to your left now, yes.
Yeah, so...
No, we should back up a little bit, because we're going to hear a lot about that development in the course of the next 45 or so minutes. But we started climbing a staircase in the way that no radio show should. And we have neglected to introduce you as our guest today, and also to sort of marvel for a moment at the view here, which, with your permission, I might do
just for
a second, because
yes,
it's blooming amazing. We've got that lovely winter late afternoon mist, as you mentioned, rising and giving everything a bit of a soft focus. Some of the buildings further back are disappearing into it, and I've certainly never seen London from here except by helicopter, which is another subject I think we may be coming to. And there's just enough sunlight penetrating the high cloud to light up the NatWest tower over there, beautiful reflection, and we can see over the Houses of Parliament a sort of a Victorian winter sunset, I would suggest.
Classic Turner, I would say.
Very much so, yes. Absolutely beautiful. Should we nudge around and have a look south? Because we were looking north there. Now we're coming round. And I haven't had a look directly down yet. This will make me go as wobbly as it usually does. Oh, my goodness, yes, we're a long way up. How many floors up here are we?
Well, the Oxford Tower Wharf itself, there's a restaurant to the top, which is on the 8th floor. And we're now the equivalent height from the river again up from the, yeah, so you're twice as high. It's one of the things, when you're looking up, the tower looks, you know, sort of smaller. But I once made a cake done in the shape of the Oxford Tower, and the tower looked just too small. So I got out the plans and I realised the tower is as tall as the building itself.
That's astonishing. And, of course, the one sense of the size of the building isn't helped by the new construction going up behind it, the South Bank Tower there, which I suspect might form another point of conversation. We should get into who you are, Ian Tuckett. I know that you're the CEO of Coin Street, but what is Coin Street?
Well, Coin Street Community Builders came out of a campaign in the 1970s and early 1980s where people in this area around Waterloo Station had decided they had to fight to stay and they wanted to build up the residential community again. And so through that period, we gradually managed to get sites where we built little housing cooperatives and persuade the planners that actually this area should keep a small, anyway, residential population. Now, at that time, the development industry was only interested in offices, nothing else really. And so, site by site, the old warehouses, the old houses got replaced by pretty large office buildings. It wasn't until sort of later in the 1980s that, in fact, pioneered by people further east, began actually living by the river and, you know, becoming a little bit of a trendy thing.
Oh, right, St. Catherine's Dock and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And indeed, at the 1979 public inquiry, people, you know, the opposing authorities and interests just said it's an inappropriate place to live here, particularly families. You know, how can families live with all these big roads and all the rest of it? So in a way, there's been a huge change, because now really the main drive of the development industry in central London, and certainly along the river, are, you know, flats, and pretty expensive flats at that.
What is the... Because that sounds very sensible, actually, not wanting families to live in amongst industrial stuff and industrial-sized stuff. Why the move against that?
Well, because families bring a sort of stability to the area. And you know, we were a community. We were a community group. And so we developed housing cooperatives, partly because there was no right to buy. So when, in the 1980s, the Thatcher government introduced right to buy, this became a pretty important thing if you wanted to have the range of employment that the centre of a city needs. You know, the reality was that, you know, whether it's the public transport or the post or, you know, just running utilities. Most of these things relied on people getting up early, being close enough to work that they didn't rely on public transport and driving in. So the functioning of the city sort of depended a lot on people who weren't paid so much actually living close to the centre. But, you know, sometimes the development industry can sort of, you know, it goes with whatever the flavour of the month is. We rely on planners, and I know planning gets knocked a lot, but actually it is planning that allows us to keep the sort of balance that a city needs between its, you know, public realm, its open spaces. You know, a lot of high-rise housing now, well, you know, people are still going to want to go for that walk, be able to lie on some grass. Those things are very important. And, you know, from a green point of view, you know, one of our arguments is why put all the load on, you know, people living outside having to commute in where most of the work was, when actually, you know, if people lived within walking distance of work, then, you know, that was essentially a much better model. And even to this day, you know, a lot of restaurants, cafes open pretty late. The tube system is closed and they get sent back by taxi. Now, if you have staff that are living closely, if it's a sunny day, they can suddenly, you know, turn up to work because there's more business to do. So really, we see mix and balance at the heart of a city as being a very, very vital matter. And what had been happening through the 1970s, right across central London, was this very sudden depopulation. So an area like Fitzrovia lost 40% of its population in the 1970s. And really, this was happening, as I say, right across Covent Garden and King's Cross. And a lot of these communities then banded together. And I was part of an organisation called Chicle, the Campaign for Homes in Central London. And, you know, eventually we persuaded, you know, the policymakers that actually it was a good idea. Well, now, of course, the market is liking housing. Wealthier people are wanting to live in the centre, and that creates a different sort of dynamic and a different sort of issue for planners to deal with.
Well, it seems almost to bring us full circle to the issue that started this part of the conversation, that of what I think Ken Livingstone started to call key workers, people doing the grunt work in the city, not really being able to get into the centre of town in terms of living here and needing to live an hour and a half out, not being able to afford the commute, concerns that are particularly pressing at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, to give Ken Livingstone his credit, I mean, he was a very early adopter of, you know, what we and other communities in central London were saying. You know, I remember many occasions when we'd go down en masse and lobby at, you know, planning committees, you know, throwing monopoly money over, trying to make a point that actually a city needs to have people living at its centre. Well, it will now. You know, all these houses that are being built, you know, there may be arguments about, and certainly are arguments about whether there's, you know, the right mix of affordable and just how expensive houses become when you're at the centre of a global, you know, city.
That almost seems to excuse the situation that there aren't enough affordable houses. I'm wondering, not that I'm suggesting you are excusing it, because clearly you do see it as an issue, but assuming the market has no conscience to speak of, then you are presumably looking at either legislation from on high and or planning policy to sort the problem out.
It's really planning that should be at the centre of things. And unfortunately what's happened is that, I guess, the idea was to save money, but whereas there used to be programs where local authorities, the housing corporation as it then was, got money from the Treasury to invest in affordable housing. Those days have sort of passed, and the attempt was to piggyback affordable housing off the back of private building. But, you know, really that's a very difficult, you know, you will get, you know, a limited number of units, but...
Well, this is where you get your quotas within a new development.
Yeah, you know, they started saying, well, let's have 50% and maybe 40%, and, you know, it's definitely, you know, if you get 20%, you're lucky, and mostly people will say, can we pay you some money in lieu of actually building the affordable housing? You go and build that affordable housing further out where it's cheaper. And of course, local authorities are so stretched for money these days that quite often they will take the money. But
I'm really shocked to hear that.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, that's that tends to be the policy.
How pronounced is the problem at this point, in your view?
Well, I think, you know, house prices are right up there as being an issue for... It's not just younger people. And really, if you can't house, you know, a sort of wide range of people, you know, close to where the jobs are, you immediately create a number of issues, whether it's for employers who are... you know, wanting to expand but find it very difficult and obviously more and more expensive. You're commuting people more, yeah, they're having to travel more, and that's not a cheap activity. You know, in the old days, I remember I worked for the Inner London Education Authority, and our local schools were full of young teachers who, you know, this is where they sort of, with all their energy, came and sort of learnt the trade and developed their experience. But you know, now if you're a young teacher, you're likely to get a job a bit closer to your home because, you know, commuting in is, you know, as I say, it's an expensive activity. So it creates issues for our schools and so it goes on.
Do you think fundamentally that people have in our society have got their heads screwed on in terms of how they view home ownership and issues around that?
Well, I think those things are changing. I think the professionals now talk about generation rent, you know, that whereas in people my age were brought up, you know, if you could at all buy a house, you did. But for a lot of people, this is just way beyond their means. But they want to live in the city and have the sort of city life. I mean, I don't want to be too gloomy about this because, you know, in this period, you know, since the 1970s, this area in particular has transformed. I mean, it used to be bleak. It used to have very few people at the weekends. I mean, you could wander around and you'd think you were in a film set. That, you know, there was no one to be seen. And the population was pretty elderly in those days. And in fact, I, you know, remember... a lot of my neighbours saying that they used to go over to the dairy in St James's Park for their milk when they were young, you know. So this has changed a lot. The South Bank. It used to be a place when I started work on, you know, the Coin Street project. We'd get architects coming over saying they were designing bridges. Why? To relieve the sense of isolation on the South Bank. Well, now the South Bank Riverside Walkway is way busier, well, you can see now, than the North Bank. And
a different sort of busy as well, because, of course, well, on the Victoria Embankment, it's all traffic, road traffic.
Yeah.
Down here we've got this glorious walkways, promenade, and little jetties that people can go out and take photographs, and you can go and walk down on the sand and do a bit of... dipping for old bits of stuff and shells by the waterfront. I mean, it's a very different vibe, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, in a way, I suppose, because the South Bank was developed much later than North Bank, we have the benefit of looking at what had happened and thinking, well, actually, don't build a road right along it. And here again, credit to the planners, they said we want a continuous riverside walkway, and site by site as things came up, they insisted that a riverside walkway be built. So, in fact, Coin Street was the body that finished this last stretch of South Bank Riverside Walkway. It used to end by the London Weekend Television.
Which is where now?
Well, it's that tall block there. So just
no, that doesn't work on radio.
Okay, it's just past the National Theatre.
Ah, right. Yes, I see. Yes. So we've got a very ugly. Do you know what? I've never realised they used to show that on the at the style of the news reports, didn't they? The big tower there. Yes, I recognise it now. Very ugly black and white stripy thing. Looks a bit like a licorice all sort. and so you've continued it from there, and we've got a helicopter.
Well, it does look like a helicopter landing, but it isn't, and we're not very keen on those. But we call it the observation platform, and you do get the most stunning views. This stretch that we did, of course, it used to have warehouses all along here, and we decided to keep Oxo Tower because of it was rather special. But the other warehouses we demolished, created Bernie Spain Gardens to link the river with the residential area behind.
So that's that lovely patch of green we can see.
Goes down there through to Stamford Street. And then the housing developments that we've done, and they're all to date housing cooperatives for people in housing need. You can see a built sort of like squares round, people have their own private gardens, and then there's a shared garden in the middle. So actually it's what used to be a very, concrete everywhere. I mean, that was what South Bank was sort of, it was concrete. And I remember shortly after the Berlin Wall came down, we got some visitors from Berlin Mitte, the centre, the east of Berlin. And after taking them round, they presented me with a lump of the Berlin Wall, and it was like, this is a bit like bringing coals to Newcastle. But now, there are more trees, there's more greenery. Jubilee Gardens, a trust of which we are part, re-landscaped that in time for the Jubilee in 2012. And, the area, despite the fact that there are more taller buildings in it, actually does feel, like it's got proper public realm, and you can look out at the river, you can enjoy green spaces, and it isn't, how it used to be.
Certainly doesn't feel as foreboding as one of the images that stuck with me is a model that I saw in the Royal Festival Hall of the South Bank pre-Festival of Britain.
Yeah.
And those wharves and warehouses that you refer to really just took up the entire bank there, and there's no chance that anybody could walk along. So was it a case then of doing individual deals with landowners, or how did that work?
Yes, it depends who owned the land, but generally you just put a requirement in their planning consent that they had to build a riverside walkway.
Isn't there a wonderful little church somewhere in Manhattan that refuses to be knocked down and completely disrupts everyone's plan? I'm just wondering whether one warehouse owner could have stymied your ambition.
Well, in a way, Oxo Tower Wharf is one that is remaining, and what we did there, if people look at it closely, they come down next time, you'll see that it both cantilevers over the riverside, but also we've built an arcade that's within the walk, within the building. So we've continued the riverside walkway, but it's both over the river and, if you like, within the building. So you can do it, and in a way that variety makes it very interesting. You'll see just down below us that as you walk along from the National Theatre, you do get to this observation platform, and then we said we're not going to build out over that what's now sand and river bank, or we called it the beach, and at that time government policy was you had to build out to what was called the Port of London Authority line, and we said no, we're not going to do that, because we want people to be able to go down onto that beach, which is really special and gives you a feeling of London that you just don't get when you're walking around amongst buildings. In the end, we managed to do that. And of course, now that is, that's the approved approach, that you don't build out over the river. So, you know, I think one has to remember a bit that the river, as I say, until the Industrial Revolution was pretty clean and it was alive with fish and so on. But it then really, because of all of the sort of materials being poured into it, it effectively was poisonous, and it killed all the fish, and you had cholera and things like that. I think it was around 1860s, the big stink, where they had to hang out sheets in front of the Houses of Parliament, and that's what sort of led to a number of schemes like, you know, the big sewers that actually go under the riverside walkways. And later on in the 1960s, there was a concerted effort to clean up the river. The docks were moving out by now, and in, I think it was the sort of mid-1970s, they threw in some young salmon, and 3 years later they began coming up stream again, and they're now well over 100 species of fish. So although I still would advise people not to drink it, that would be pretty foolish. It's a lot cleaner, but
although you still hear of rowers routinely going down with all sorts of lurgy because they've touched the water.
You certainly don't want to drink it, and in fact, if you come along to what I call the beach, and you'll see the sand around Gabriel's Wharf, and go down onto the river, take a stick and just dig down through that sand. It's not deep before you get into some very black and stinky material. So underneath, you know, it's still there, but you know, the river is, you know, now alive again, and it was one of the first sort of triumphs of concerted attempt to clean up the river.
Well, we've quite intentionally found ourselves talking about a couple of campaigns here. We're going to take a short break to get a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back to talk about a couple of different campaigns.
Thank you.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
I am at the top of the Oxo Tower. I mean, right at the top of the Oxo Tower. I can touch the green bit. And I'm here with Ian Tuckett from Coin Street Community Builders. And as the attentive listener will have spotted in the first half of today's show, it's not all peace and quiet up here. There is much building work in evidence. We can hear drills going away there. And if we come over to the east side of the tower, we can see the South Bank Tower there. It's been stripped down to its skeleton. And you mentioned they're making it even taller.
Yeah, it used to be the IPC building, and they're adding 11 stories to it.
To bring it to a total of...
pass.
I mean, is it 11 on top of what we can see there?
Yeah.
So that must be 25 stories or something like that?
It'll be, I suspect, taller than that. But it's interesting in that they've kept the basic structure, which never really worked as an office, you know, which is one of the reasons IPC moved out, just across the other side of Blackfriars Road. But, there'll be people living there, and obviously... You know, if you have more people living in this area, that's probably going to benefit, you know, the shops and make it a little bit more lively.
And, well, I was going to come to see Containers House, and it's one of those buildings that I've often pondered on.
Yeah.
And I've wondered about the history, so I might pick your brain for information there. But as my eyes travel across between the two buildings, there's a new one here with a roof at a rather strange angle. What's this building all about?
Okay, that is a building on Blackfriars Road. It'll be finished this year. Why it's got the cut off the edge, who knows?
I had a theory. I wonder if this theory is going to work. I'm just
having a look. Probably rights of light.
Yes. My bet is. Let me hang. I'm just going to pop round the tower here. Let's go have a look. Yeah, I think this might work. Okay, I know that that St Paul's Cathedral's got a protected sight line from Richmond Park. It couldn't be that, could it?
I doubt it, but there is a protected view which you can see. The reason that the ITV tower is set back is to allow the view from the Houses of Parliament, of Westminster Pier, of St Paul's. And so between, I think it is the National Theatre Fly Tower and the ITV building, you get this little view. And that's great. I mean, it's one of the exciting things about living in a city. You suddenly get these exciting views of somewhere which suddenly tells you, oh, right, that's where it is. Because walking along, as I say, this big bend in that we have in the river, it's very easy to suddenly think, why is St Paul's on the south bank? You know, because it you know, sometimes you're walking, if you walk along the river, you're walking from south to north, and sometimes you're walking west to east. So it's quite a confusing area if you don't know the know it well.
Yes, in fact, while I was waiting to meet you earlier on, I was ridiculously early. I'm not going to give the impression you were late or anything. There were a number of people stopping at the viewing gallery a few floors down from here, and to a person, every single person said exactly that.
Yes.
Well, we should come to see Container's house, but I wanted to ask you, what were the first indications that you were going to be on a path that would lead you to the top of the Octo Tower?
Well, I started working County Hall when it was on, you know, just by Westminster Bridge, working for the Inner London Education Authority. And because I worked, I came to live here. And then, you know, there were some people sort of beginning to organise, and I joined them, and it was a fantastic way to get to know your neighbours. And because a lot of my neighbours had all grown up together, and indeed their parents and their parents' parents before that, once you got to know a few, everyone knew you. So it was in many ways a very friendly area. It's grown enormously, but it still has fantastic links between different community groups, between the community groups and the politicians, and indeed between now and part of the work you know, that I've done is to bring all the South Bank employers together. And so you know, since 1990 there, we've had all the employers, big employers like Shell and the arts bodies all meeting. And so there's a lot of talking about what is the right way forward for the area, and there's been a real concerted effort to try and make it better. We have a marketing group that promotes the area, and we have all sorts of forums like the South Bank Forum, which meet quarterly, chaired by our two local MPs, Kate Hoey and Simon Hughes, and the ward councillors. And people can just turn up and speak about whatever issues that they want to, but also, you know, they hear about developments planned, they give their views about whether the licensing laws are adequate. And this is a fantastic area for communication and engagement and participation, and it's sort of a model that I think could be rolled out a lot of other places. Because if you can do it in the heart of a big city like London, I believe you can pretty much do it in any neighbourhood.
The idea of engagement, well, not just engagement, agency, seems to run through what I know about you so far, activism and seeing the bigger picture, but crucially seeing the potential to change things around and transform. I wonder what you do that is passive in your life, or where you're the recipient of something and not the actor.
Well, listening is a pretty important part. If you want, you know, to change things, you've got to listen to people first. But it is that question that people need to ask. What if, you know, imagine what may seem initially impossible, because people's horizons tend to be a lot lower than they need to be. Sometimes you just got to, you know, think, what if? And that's what stimulates the possibilities. I'm fortunate in, you know, I work with a fantastic group of people, both the staff and my board, and you know, the, you know, some of the local politicians, and you know, the people who get involved from the businesses. And so, you know, whereas very much in the 1970s I felt of myself as a member of the Waterloo community, meaning residential, now I sort of feel part of, you know, the Waterloo and South Bank community, which is, you know, the arts organisations, it's the businesses, it's the residents, it's the students, and we've got, you know, King's College not far away is, you know, the LSE, a little bit further south is South Bank University. And, you know, it's this fantastic mix. And that's really, I think, the great challenge now is to keep that mix and balance, because it's very easy, just like, you know, the property industry sort of suddenly wanting all offices or all housing. It's very easy to lose that mix. You know, people will want to build on any open space that's going. But it is that mix and balance that I think makes this area so special, and I think is what gives it a healthy economy. When the rest of the country was suffering because of the 2007 sort of economic debacle, this area actually kept on increasing the number of visitors, the trade in the local restaurants and so on. There were changes. The London Eye, for instance, the proportion of people from abroad increased, not least because the pound was dropping in value. But the numbers grew. And so the economy here is a very, very strong one. But it's also, you know, you can live here, you can walk, you know, whether it's to the National Theatre, the South Bank Centre, or across into Covent Garden and all of that. It's something which is... It's just a beautiful place to live and work.
Listener, I would like you to admire the finesse with which that answer was given. That was, I mean, some people would have answered, like, I listened to a bit of Beethoven or something. You're quite clearly a fantastic spokesman for the area and for your vision and for the vision of the residents and the players in the area, yeah. People contributing to make this what it is. And one of those contributors is Sea Containers House. And I'd love to know, is it as straightforward as it sounds? Is that administration or something?
It's got a fantastic history, in fact. Originally, when it got permission 1969-1970, it was meant to be a hotel, an apartment hotel. And
Hold on, it was always meant to be a hotel?
Yeah.
So has it ever been anything to do with Sea Containers?
What happened was that they built the basic structure of the hotel, but never completed it, and it remained empty. And then they got permission to convert 20% of it into offices, because I mentioned offices were now the thing. It was, in fact, meant to be the planning game, this hotel, for the IPC tower just behind that we were talking about. And what it was meant to do was bring life to the riverside. All along its the bottom were shop units that were meant to, you know, enliven this stretch. In fact, it never was completed as a hotel. First off, it was 20%, and then it was 50%, and then eventually they got permission to turn it all into offices. And Sea Containers was one company there, and the other part of it was Customs and Excise. So those were the two people who occupied those offices. Indeed, at the time, Customs and Excise came down to me and they had a problem because their staff were refusing to move to the South Bank. And there is somewhere a video, which they made of me standing amongst demolition happening on our site and saying, well, here will be a park and here will be, you know, homes and this, that, and it'll all be wonderful in the future. The staff just didn't want to move down to the South Bank. Well, now, of course, people are very happy because it's just a much, you know, more relaxed and mixed place than, you know, being in a city where you can sometimes struggle to get a seat, you know, or whatever at lunchtime. So then what has happened most recently is permission has been given to change the existing structure into a hotel. And so we're going to have a Mondrian Hotel opening in the spring or the summer this year. And that'll have restaurants and cafes along the riverside. So that really will bring and deliver some of the original promises. And also, I think Ogilvy and Mather and Puma are going to move into the offices. So, you know, some great lets for that. We've slightly suffered during the redevelopment period. The riverside walkway was closed for a time. You know, the upper ground was closed, but
That was when you had to walk around the Tate.
Yeah. And well, in fact, for 3 years before that, the Riverside Walkway was closed because of the building of the Thames Link and the station, which we can see just there, crossing over. So Blackfriars Station used only to be accessible from the North Bank, but now they've extended the station right across on the platforms, right across the river. They now have an entrance also from the South Bank, just beyond Oxo, and that's great. I mean, you know, but we suffered because it did close for 3 years, but, you know, you have to put up sometimes with that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so I promised we'd come to a couple of more campaigns, I should say, and let's do them in the following order. Things that other people are campaigning against and things that you have been and continue to campaign against. On the way here, walking along, there was a trestle table with people who were protesting against the moving of the skate park, and I gather, digging a little deeper into this, that there's a big switch of use and there's a lot more commercial stuff going in on that area. I think these guys are being relocated down to somewhere near Hungerford Bridge. Well, I just wanted to get your take on what's happening there. It seems to be rousing a lot of sentiment against the move.
Yeah, it's certainly been highly contentious, and in fact, I've got a sort of 12-year-old and a 9-year-old who are absolutely passionate about skateboarding, and they were some of the first to sort of sign their long-lived South Bank sort of petition and so on. And to their credit, you know, the campaigners have really been dedicated. They're out there all the time collecting signatures and so on. And I think part of the problem was that the story wasn't properly explained and told to people. You know, you very quickly got a scheme, a proposal, and gradually, as people looked at it, they realised actually their skate park, and indeed, you know, because it's been going for 20-odd years, you know, their fathers and their father's father, maybe, and, you know...
Not in 20 years.
not in 20 years, no, but, it was amazing how many people just got involved. And I think that came as quite a shock to the South Bank Centre. Now, to their credit, I think they've reacted by saying, OK, we're going to treat this seriously. You know, they have commissioned skateboarding designers. They have really gone out to try and explain why and what they're doing. Now, I'm not going to take sides in this one, if you don't mind, but I do think, you know, there is now a proposal about how it could be, and it's not that far away, and they have certainly got a story that has begun to sway my my kids, but you know, I wouldn't want to take sides on that one.
Perhaps I can ask a more hypothetical question. I'm not sure. You know, I'm just going to go from the boring retail angle. Every high street, and there are a lot of sort of villagey high streets, town high streets that have all blended into one big city. So we've got a lot of high streets in this capital, and they've all got the same shops on them, selling the same stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't there some sort of a basic, I'm not sure whether it's arts or aesthetics or some sort of a principle, which I think you've been espousing earlier on in this interview, of sort of individualism and balance that would seem to speak in favour of keeping something as unique as that and maybe excluding things that you can find anywhere?
I absolutely agree. In fact, I'm very passionate about the need for the South Bank to be, have its own identity as far as possible for, you know, people to find shops and activities that are really quite different from everywhere else. So I think this is a real issue that has got to be addressed by everyone developing along here, because it is a whole identity of an area we're talking about. It's a brand, South Bank brand. And it should be about creativity, the arts, individualism. This is what will make it special. I admire very much what Duke Kelly has done in terms of animating the outside, because I've certainly, for a long time had the South Bank Centre as a body that withdrawn from, you know, putting things on outside. Once they used to program stuff on Jubilee Gardens, and then that all stopped. Jude has sort of turned that around. I think there are, however, big questions about, you know, I was walking along recently and I suddenly thought, do you know, I haven't seen the river. Where's the river was behind this series of huts that were selling, well, you know, tat, to be honest.
Very expensive sausages, I've discovered.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm not against, but actually, let's not block off the river. And, now this sort of activity, can happen in the summer and the winter. And I think more care has got to be taken by all of us to ensure that the experience of coming down here is really special, and that, you know, come down here one year, you'll find something different from the year before. And, you know, part of what we've been trying to do with the design studios in Oxo, Tower Wharf and in Gabriel's is, you know, to have unique sort of one-offs that, make it special, that you can't find it everywhere. Now, of course, sometimes these people have been very, very successful, and I went over to New York and went into the Museum of Modern Art shop, and it was actually full of old, you know, stuff that, you know, been created by designers at Oxo. So my ideas of buying presents, you know, fell rather flat there. But, you know, I think you have to constantly be tending. It's like gardening, looking after the city. And I think management and maintenance are the big issues now that on the South Bank that we are all now beginning to really focus on. We've got the crowds, we've got the mix. Now we've really got to make sure that we can cope with the numbers that are coming, we can ensure that they have a great experience, and that we can make use and not exploit, you know, the river and, you know, the green spaces that have been created.
This idea of sort of nurturing the environment with a small e, the built environment, to some extent the green environment, actually, as we've seen, maybe at the root of your feeling towards helicopter traffic in the area. You seem to have strong views there.
Yes, well, after the war, they designated the river as the helicopter route across London.
For safety's sake?
Yes, for safety's sake. And most helicopters have a single engine or whatever, you know.
Propeller.
That's the ones. those great choppers, anyway. And so they put it over the river. And as I say, at that time, the river wasn't, you know, popular and used like it is now. You know, it had boats, but it was, you know, otherwise not a... It wasn't, you know, greatly visited. But as the river has become more of a leisure thing and more people, particularly recently, are now living, the having helicopters overflying, they do make a lot of noise. And so Coin Street has long campaigned against, and we were part of a campaign that led to the shutting of the Trigg Lane heliport by the city. There was for the top of sea containers. And when we bought Oxford Tower Wharf, there were two barges moored off on which, adjacent to it, where there were four helicopters landing and taking off every day. And the very first decision we took as Coin Street Community Builders was to serve notice, even though it meant a loss of income stream for us, because we wanted, you know, the area to get quieter. And I think there is a greater understanding now. There's still a helicopter port at Battersea, but we've seen some other proposals for a floating heli port that was going to go up and down the river, and I think there's a greater awareness that it is pretty intrusive and is a much more public use of the river. So, you know, people don't really want the amount of noise. And of course, we have right opposite us the temple, so there's some good lawyers that have sometimes supported us. You've got facilities like the Globe, which, you know, it can be pretty disruptive.
And well, I mean, all this sounds perfectly reasonable, but then the listener will have detected the police sirens and the building works, and it's, yeah. I mean, it really isn't so quiet at the moment, is it?
It certainly isn't, and you know, we are standing next door to, you know, a building site and a demolition site, and, yeah, it is pretty noisy at the moment. Not when you get down on the river, you don't notice it so much, but up here, where we're pretty close to where the action is, we're certainly picking up the sound, yeah.
Does that not go some way against your argument that noise is part of city life?
Well, I'd like, you know, there to be a lot less noise, and electric cars, which look, you know, more and more possible, and some of, you know, these changes, I suspect, technology will help us.
One only has to think, I suppose, of Victorian London with horseshoes and cobbles.
Yeah.
This must be quite an improvement by comparison.
Yeah, I wasn't alive in those days.
I wasn't suggesting it was a personal memory. Well, we've got to come to a close here. And between you and me, I'm really hoping to string the conversation out for at least another few days so I can stay up here and admire this astonishing view. The evening has fallen as we've been talking. All the lights have come on along the riverfront. The city is illuminated. St. Paul's is lit up. This is a gorgeous place.
It is fantastic, and you know, one thing that we did do with OXO when we let the top floor to the Harvey Nichols for the restaurant and the brasserie was we kept open as part of this a viewing platform, so you can come up to the eighth floor and just enjoy the view of the river from this point. You know, there are some fantastic designer makers on the first and second floors, and you won't find more creative people. And so, great place to come and do your Christmas shopping.
Christmas shopping, and by the sounds of it, get in before they become globally renowned and far too expensive.
Yeah.
Ian Tuckett, thanks very much.
Thanks very much. It's been great talking to you. My heart aches for some far off place. No
one could have left you with your name, how you raised. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Ian Tuckett. Thanks too to Mark Barr, Louise King, and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
We're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.